Hi, welcome to this week's program. I know almost all my listeners have heard of 401ks, and a lot of you have them in your retirement portfolios. But while 401ks offer a lot of benefits, like anything else, they have downsides too, and you must assess your financial situation carefully before going all in on your 401k. This is also about those of you who work for government or nonprofit, so it includes 457s as well. So to make sure you get the most from your plan, I plan to talk about 401k pros and cons, with a special focus on the cons, because 9 in 10 Americans are not aware of the downsides of 401ks and how they might be better off supplementing their 401k with other investment options. So let's start with the pros. A 401k is basically a savings plan that allows employees to make tax-deductible contributions towards retirement, where the money goes straight from your paycheck to the plan before you can lay your hands on it. And that's a good thing because you learn to make do with smaller paycheck, so think of it as a form of forced savings. What's neat about this tax deferral is that you get to invest more than if you had to pay taxes on that amount, and you compound this money without paying current tax today, which helps you build a larger nest egg. Now, the government always gets its cut, so you'll have to pay taxes on the distributions when you take them later in life, hopefully at a lower rate of tax than when you made your contributions. For 2017, your contribution is limited to $18,000, but if you're age 50 or more, you can make an additional $6,000 in catch-up contributions every year to a maximum of $24,000. So these are fairly generous and meaningful limits, with the intent of helping you build up for a comfortable retirement. And remember, it's elective. It's not mandatory. Every year, you get to decide how much you want to contribute towards the plan, if at all. Another great feature of these plans is that employers have the option of making contributions to your plan. Typically, employers make matching contributions based on the amount you put in, and their match can go from anywhere from nothing to 100%. If your employer offers matching contributions but you don't have a 401k plan set up, you're missing out on free money. So I strongly urge you to take advantage of this matching feature. With a 401k, your employer works with a plan administrator and decides what you can invest in. Most plans offer a fairly limited set of 10 to 12 investment options, such as mutual funds, exchange-traded funds or ETFs, or index funds, and you can change your investments at least once every quarter. So the upside here is that your investment options are tailored to offer a reasonable degree of diversification while focusing on safety and acceptable market risk. This dampens speculation and helps employees stay invested over the long run, which is vital to growing wealth. Also, employers offer a plan document every year that highlights investment options, how often you can change your investments, your fees, and so on. Most companies also hold planning sessions every year for employees, so attend those meetings and stay on top of the plan features and changes. And if you ever have any questions about your plan, talk to your HR department. They should be able to help you out. Now, in my list of 401k pros and cons, here's the last pro. The IRS permits early withdrawals from your plan before you reach age 59 and a half, but it makes you pay a 10% penalty on that early withdrawal. So dipping into your plan before age 59 and a half is not a good idea. But that said, if you withdraw money for medical expenses or disability, the IRS waives the 10% penalty, which is nice because it gives you liquidity in the face of financial hardship. All right, so that covers the major benefits of 401k plans. Now let's talk about the cons. Let's start with the tax deductible feature. While the original intent was that you'd be in a lower income tax bracket when you retire because you won't be earning as much, this is not always the case. If you've done well professionally and you've invested well through the years, mandatory retirement withdrawals and other sources of income, say rental income from real estate, could put you in a higher tax bracket than when you were working. As a result, you could pay more in taxes than if you had simply invested your money after tax originally, or better yet, in vehicles like the Roth IRA, where you pay no future tax on your gains. So the tax benefits of a 401k may not always work in your favor, and you could end up shouldering a big tax liability if your portfolio does well and you end up in a higher income bracket than when you started, which can often be the case. Moreover, if the bulk of your savings in a 401k and similar tax-deferred vehicles could lead to a situation where most of your future income is taxable. So after-tax investments have their own benefits. Here's a really good example. Let's say you're over age 70 and a half and you have $2 million in tax-deferred assets, $150,000 in already taxed assets, and let's say you need $50,000 to live every year. Now remember, the government wants the taxes you owe them, so on that $2 million, you'll have to withdraw what's called the required minimum distribution, known as the RMD. This RMD comes from your tax-deferred retirement accounts. At $2 million, the RMD works out to about $73,000. So now you're in a situation where you have to withdraw an extra $23,000 that you don't need and pay taxes on it. So having too much in tax-deferred assets doesn't always work to your advantage. And in case you're wondering how I got that $73,000 RMD figure, it's based on a governmental formula, and I've included a link to it on my website, stevepomerantz.com. Now, it also does not always make sense to invest to the max. You should assess your situation and talk to a knowledgeable financial advisor to see if you should go all in and invest up to the contribution limit, or if you should restrict your contribution to just the amount that would get you the full employer matching contribution. But to be clear about one thing, make sure you get the entire amount of the employer match because that's free money. Now, the investment part of this equation is a bit of a minefield. For one, the options offered are often too limited and are made up of stodgier and more expensive funds. While stodgy may be good as you're approaching retirement age, it's not so good if you're young. And depending on your age, it may make sense to minimize your 401k and direct your monies to where you have more aggressive investment choices. The other downside is that the plan administrator may direct you to mutual funds they manage or have an interest in, and this is in order to maximize their own fees and expenses at the expense of your nest egg. This conflict of interest is a major problem with how 401ks are administered, and there was a study by NerdWallet in 2013 which found that 93% of all Americans dramatically underestimated the total 401k fees that they paid over a lifetime. More than half thought the lifetime fees would be under $50,000, but the reality is that the average household with two working adults will pay about $150,000 to $200,000 in fees over their lifetime. The good news in all this is that all this bad publicity has stirred a move towards lower fees and better investment options, but still, 401k-related fees are still pretty high, so double-check the fees you'll pay before you sign up. You know, and as I always say, make sure any investment you make makes sense for your particular situation, and the same goes for the 401k. If you have high credit card debt, or student loans, or need to save for a down payment on a house, maybe you want to take care of that first. If you don't have at least 4 to 6 months of your pay in emergency funds, build that up first. Then, after you've taken care of the essentials, see if you should open up a 401k. Finally, remember that bit about hardship withdrawals? You could always tap into investments in after-tax funds without penalties, but if you mostly put it all in tax-deferred assets, you will have to pay the 10% penalty. So think carefully about 401k pros and cons and wisely allocate your funds so you don't have to pay taxes on all your withdrawals in retirement. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Ever wonder whether those large buying clubs like Costco and BJ's offer significant savings on things other than your basic 15-pack of paper towels and 40 pounds of dog food? Well, Kiplinger has come to our rescue, and Lisa Gerstner is with me to talk about it. Hey, Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So are there greater savings on other items?
Yes. So the warehouse clubs offer all kinds of other kind of financial related services, and you can often get a discount. Sometimes they offer their own where they come up with the programs themselves. And sometimes, often really, they contract with other services like LifeLock or insurance companies, and you'll be able to get discounts that you wouldn't be able to get otherwise if you went through these programs through other avenues.
You know, you don't really think about buying large items in a Costco or a BJ's. For example, can you buy a car through these companies?
Yes, actually, BJ's, Costco, and Sam's Club all offer car buying services. So what this means is if you really hate to haggle, you don't like going to the dealer and having kind of that confrontational aspect of trying to get a better price on a car, they offer services where it's a predetermined price that you get. Mm-hmm. So they've kind of done a little bit of the work for you, you know, that you're going to get a little bit of a better price than you might if you just walked in and bought the car and didn't haggle at all. And so they're all a little different. Costco's program is kind of run through Costco, and they generally will connect you with one dealer in your area based on the kind of car you want, and mm-hmm. then you can work with the dealer from there. Sam's Club actually works through TrueCar, and TrueCar is kind of its own service. You may have seen it through other companies that contract with TrueCar. You may be able to use it separately. But what TrueCar does is they'll send you kind of multiple dealers in your area who may have the type of car you want, and you can kind of go through those options. And then the BJ's does something sort of similar. You can go onto their website and look up the kind of car you want and then see, you know, kind of these different dealers in your area offer this car. And then you can have the dealer contact you if you're interested in the car. So they all operate a little differently.
They're offering a fixed price for the car. Is that what you're seeing here? As opposed to going into the dealership and starting to haggle, they're going to say, you want to buy, you know, X and X car, and the cost is this. Mm-hmm. Is that it?
Yeah, so typically it'll start that way. They'll say, here's what we can offer you. But we found that they'll even haggle a bit further often. Uh-huh. You're not necessarily limited to what the program dictates. So
okay.
Maybe they start with one price, and if you are interested in haggling a little more, so even if you are someone who likes to do that, it may be a good mm-hmm. place to start.
Okay, well, that's very cool. What about credit cards?
Yeah.
You know, I know that, of course, these clubs have their own credit cards, which, you know, give you access to buying their stuff, but what do they do in the credit card area?
Yeah, so all of them offer credit cards, and I think they're all attractive in their own right, depending on which club you join. Sam's Club is attractive especially because of the gas rebates. So they offer 5% cash back on up to $6,000 spent yearly on gas, which is, that's a good rebate, 5%.
Right, that is.
3% on dining and travel, and then 1% on everything else.
Mm-hmm.
It's really kind of a good all-around package on that one. Costco is also similarly kind of a good all-around. You get 4% back on up to $7,000 you spend a year on gas. So not quite as high, but still pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
3% on dining and travel, and then you also get 2% on Costco purchases. So that's nice because they offer you a little bit of a boost on in-store purchases.
Okay.
And then the 1% on everything. And then BJ's, I think, is attractive because if you really want an in-store good rebate, that's where you want to look because they do either 5% or 3% on BJ's purchases, depending on your membership level. And then 2% restaurants and gas stations, 1% everything else. So pretty good all-around spending.
Yeah, you're getting the membership club discounted price. But in addition to that, if you have the card, you're getting another 3% or so.
Right. So
okay.
It's a good in-store rebate mm-hmm. on that one.
What about gasoline? I mean, these stores are very popular, especially Costco, for getting gasoline. Can you get a discount on those too?
Yeah. So typically with these cards, you know, sometimes with other general credit cards, you can't always get a rebate at warehouse club gas stations. But if you're using the club's own card, you usually can. So that's nice. You can go to the Costco or the Sam's Club station, use the corresponding credit card there and get a rebate. BJ's does that too. They do a 10 cent per gallon discount at BJ stations with their credit card.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, it's a pretty good deal.
I'm talking with Lisa Gerstner. She's with Kiplinger, and we're talking about these big discount clubs to see what other kinds of savings they may have on other items, especially kind of financial services items. One item that you picked that was kind of surprised me was identity theft protection.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's really getting aware of that, especially with the recent Experian scandal. Tell us about those.
Yeah, that's certainly become relevant. It has been for a long time, really. But yeah, Costco and Sam's Club both have some offerings there. Costco works through a program called Complete ID, which is affiliated with the credit agency Experian. And it's a pretty good deal. It's $9 for an executive membership person or $14 a month for Gold Star members. And so it's a nice package. You get monitoring of your credit reports from all three credit agencies, which is helpful. Mm-hmm. They'll look at all the agencies for any suspicious activity on your credit reports, new accounts opened that may not have been yours. They'll alert you of that, which is nice. They'll look at black market internet sites to look for any stolen personal information that may be out there on you, like your social security number, criminal record monitoring in case someone is arrested in your name, stuff like that. So it's a pretty good deal. And then Sam's Club also does a partnership with LifeLock. So you can get 20% or 25% off based on your membership level. Mm-hmm. And LifeLock has a little bit more variation. They have, I think, at least three different packages you can choose from, and you'll get a discount on any package you pick with them. And they have many similar offerings depending on which package it is.
Fascinating. All right, let's move on to insurance. Can you get a better deal with insurance?
Yeah, so Costco kind of has the widest range of options. They do dental, auto, homeowners, life insurance, all of those fall under their umbrella. You can get discounted auto and home insurance through Ameriprise with them. And depending on your membership level, if you're an executive member, you might be able to get some extra perks too, like roadside assistance with your auto insurance. Life insurance comes through Protective Life Insurance, and you get preferred rates. They do have a health insurance marketplace, but they're focusing more on their kind of business group insurance. So if you're a small business owner, you might want to look into that for them. Lots of options with Costco. And then BJ's does do a discount through Geico on auto premiums. And depending on which club you join, you may also be able to get a homeowner's discount along with that auto insurance discount. I think it varies by club with that one.
One of the other services mentioned was tax preparation, but I don't think you guys came out with a recommendation there.
Yeah, so they have a partnership at Sam's Club with 1-800-ACCOUNTANT, which is kind of a virtual tax service, and you can get discounted income tax prep for members with Sam's Club. And what we found is a couple reasons you might want to go with a local accountant for that. One is that if you have a really simple return, on average, you'll still pay a little more through 1-800-ACCOUNTANT through the Sam's Club, even with the discount, just based on average figures. You might as well get someone local if you're going to pay more if you go through 1-800-ACCOUNTANT. Now, you might save money if you have a more complex return, if you have itemized deductions and extra schedules and all these things to deal with. The price may be better through 1-800-ACCOUNTANT, but if you're getting to that level where it's a really complex return, you might be better off just finding someone local, finding a good match, you know, talking to people face-to-face where you can go in. So we think maybe take a pass on that one. Mm-hmm. There's probably better options in your own town.
We're running out of time, so let's move quickly to mortgage lending. I think the big thing with mortgage lending in your report was that there's a cap on fees, which is attractive, but then again, you've got to kind of watch because these fees are fungible. They can be a cap in one place and they can put it in another place as well.
That's exactly right. So Costco does offer kind of mortgage shopping. You can go in and see what rates you can get from partner lenders through Costco. Definitely worth a look, but like you said, the fee cap is attractive, but you have to make sure you're not paying more via the interest rate or some other option. So just shop around, you know, look at local lenders. Look through other sites like Bankrate or LendingTree and just make sure you're getting the best deal you can.
All right. So what does it cost to join these wholesale clubs? BJ's, what does that cost?
BJ's, it's $50 or $100, depending on the membership level that you want. Costco is $60 or $120. These are regular memberships. There's also business too. And then Sam's Club is $45 or $100.
To get this kind of information, Kiplinger is a great source for all of you. So I highly recommend picking up or going online and subscribing to Kiplinger's. And to hear, you know, this interview again, don't forget to come to our website at stevepomerantz.com. You'll get a summary of the vital lessons learned here today. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our weekly update where we'll send you important lessons from the show straight to your inbox. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. I know that there are millions out there that are advancing in life and career and doing their best to fit into the messages from our culture. These messages urge us to work ever harder and to always say yes to opportunity. I also know that a large proportion of these individuals suffer great anxiety and fears because innately, they're really introverts struggling to be someone they're not. So I found this book, Hiding in the Bathroom, an Introvert's Roadmap to Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay at Home. The author is Maura Ahrens-Mealy, and she joins me today. Hey, Maura, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Steve.
So first, how do I know if I'm an introvert?
Well, so there's no blood test, right? I actually have a quiz in the front of my book. Mm-hmm. First of all, I want to say, though, that not all introverts are quiet. Not all introverts are shy. You can't pick an introvert out of a room at a cocktail party. In fact, one of the biggest introverts you know might be that person who's enthralling everyone with a story or up on stage giving an amazing sales pitch. So I think that there's a lot of misconceptions about what introverts are and that that's confusing for many of us. If you're an introvert, you probably do your best work in a quiet environment. You like to be alone and you feel really sort of centered and focused. You might also, if you're sort of out and about, whether it's being in a loud or bright open plan office all day or at some sort of cocktail party or professional networking event or whatever, school, your kid's school function, you feel like Superman and kryptonite is sort of draining the energy out of you, right?
Yeah.
You need breaks. That's where hiding in the bathroom comes from.
How many people really are in the bathroom for other reasons? That's the question of the hour.
Many, trust me. You know, but really, extra people and large crowds drain you and you recharge and draw energy through alone time. You also, one of the things that I think is very common among introverts, which I think is one of our secret superpowers, is we have active internal monologues. Mm-hmm. We think and recharge and have creative thoughts with ourselves. Which can be hard because sometimes people think we're not present, we're not ambitious, we don't care, we're not even as smart as the other person, say, in a meeting who's talking a lot. And that's just not true.
Wow, that's a lot of great information. You describe in the book the way social media has changed the way people present themselves to the world, and you use this term FOMO, F-O-M-O, the fear of missing out. Describe the situation that we find ourselves in social media these days.
You know, FOMO is so prevalent in every aspect of your life, right? So if you're dating, you know, if you're a teenager, I hear this all the time from young kids, if they're not invited to a party and they see everyone else they know on Instagram looking like they're having the time of their life, they feel horrible about themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're like me and you're a grown-up, you're over 40, you also might see friends having a great time without you, or you might see someone you went to college with, right, who just got an award or who wrote an article or, you know, wow, you can't even get your kids fed Cheerios for dinner and your good friend is making them perfect bento box lunches are my personal bugaboo. It's a big thing right now. Mm-hmm. What did you feed your kid for lunch? How much did you run? So the thing to remember is we all feel it. I have talked to some of the most successful people in the world, the kind of people who engender this FOMO, and they feel FOMO, right? Because there's always someone richer, smarter, thinner, whatever. So A, it's human. We all feel it. And B, it's what social media was designed for. That's how they keep us addicted, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to get into that aspect of it because on social media, and I'm thinking specifically of Facebook, you know, you are kind of putting your shining and shiny self forward all the time. You talk about, you know, a disagreement you had with your husband. You called him a Facebook dad. What is a Facebook dad to you? What does that mean?
My poor husband. You know, in full disclosure, I adore him. We were going through a rough patch. He actually had a book and he wasn't home very much. And yet he has this gift for taking uncannily cute photos of our children and finding perfect sort of cute aw shucks anecdotes. Mm-hmm. He put them on Facebook, and everyone we know would say to me, even offline, oh man, you're so lucky. Your husband is the best dad. Mm-hmm. He's always with your kids. I wanted to be like, that is, you know what? He's just taking these moments and sharing them and creating the illusion.
Yeah.
It's so easy, you know? And look, I get it. I mean, I'm trying to sell a book right now. So what am I doing? I'm curating those moments of fabulosity so that people think that I'm worth paying attention to. It's actually a fantastic business skill. And for introverts, especially, or people like me who are hermits who like to work at home, internet curated fabulousness actually can be a strategic tool, but it can also make us feel really bad.
The book is Hiding in the Bathroom, an introvert's roadmap to getting out there when you'd rather stay at home. So we want to kind of help you with your goal here of selling more books. The author is Maura Ahrens Mealy, and we're talking about kind of existing in a world where you really kind of many times just don't want to do stuff. I want to continue with the social media idea, because you talked about even pregnancy is becoming a performance. I mean, so-and-so has a baby bump, and we see that picture. And you have a quote, someone said to you, I just feel like we're living in an age when women are supposed to perform pregnancy. I mean, what is this coming down to here?
Yes, and that's the amazing author, Chimamanda Adichie, who, you know, is a very famous person, right? Beyonce quoted her in a song, and she had a baby and no one knew. And people were kind of pissed at her. Like, how dare you not show us your baby bump?
Yeah.
And I think that that is really kind of incredible. You know, we fetishize certain life moments. You know, there's also these new things, promposals, right? Where young people now record a, will you go to prom with me on social media and broadcast it for everyone to see.
Wow.
I do think that there's something performative to these life milestones now that actually, and if you look at the data, it really supports it. It makes us anxious. The baby bump thing is wonderful, but if you're a person who's struggling with infertility and you're watching your friend's bump reveal party on Facebook, this is also a new thing, or gender reveal, God, it can make you feel bad. So again, I think it's about having a level of consciousness about all this.
All right, well, let's talk about the cure for this. Not that there is a pill you can take, of course, but you call it leaning out. Instead of leaning in, leaning out, or JOMO, the joy of missing out. What is that?
Yeah, JOMO is a term coined by Anil Dash, who's a fantastic entrepreneur. And he discovered JOMO when he had his first kid, and he stayed home a lot, right? Because you're not going out partying if you have a newborn at home. At least I hope you're not. And he would sort of look at all of his wonderful friends doing wonderful things and think, gosh, I'm glad I'm not there. It's more important what I'm doing here. And one of the things that I really wanted to get across with my book is I tried to be someone mega. I wanted to be a movie mogul or a media executive.
Yeah.
I quit 9 jobs before I was 30 because I kept trying for those big jobs and it wasn't who I am. Mm-hmm. I'm introverted. I'm anxious. I'm a hermit. I do my best work at home in my yoga pants, but I never got those messages, right? How could I be successful if I wasn't that person?
Yeah. I mean, Richard Branson on LinkedIn and all of the little ads or clips that he has on Facebook. I mean, it's never really about anything like that.
It's never about saying no.
Yeah. Every day is a tug of war, you write, between your ambition and your anxiety. But you're saying that anxiety is really not a bad thing because it drives you to do more. It can actually be a gift. How can anxiety be a gift?
You know, if you're the kind of person, and there are many of us, you know, estimates would say a quarter to a third of people at any time are feeling some sort of generalized anxiety. Social anxiety is actually the third most diagnosed mental illness. And that is that feeling. It's different than introversion, where you might walk into a room and think, I'm not worth it. Everyone hates me. I have nothing good to say. I get it. I struggle with it.
Yeah.
You know, it's tough and you have to take care of it, but it also forces you to create a life that you need to take care of yourself. You build scaffolding, you build infrastructure. You might have to say no. You might have to discover the joy of missing out. And actually, that can be incredibly freeing. The other thing is that anxiety makes you in touch at work. If you're in touch with your anxiety, I have interviewed many people in my book and elsewhere who are so in touch with their anxiety, they talk about it with their teams And it makes them fantastic managers and teammates. Because instead of being the person, and this is true for introverts as well, I think, who's always showing off, who has to be the smartest person in the room, who's taking up air, you can be the person who's tuning in, who's reading the room, talking when necessary, and really solving problems. And that is what good work is all about.
You write about setting boundaries and setting limits or implementing limits. First of all, we really don't have that much time left, but I would think setting boundaries is the most important thing you can do to start the process. Take us through that a little.
Setting boundaries is the work of a lifetime, right? And what I learned, what I didn't know, is that the limit is actually the physical implementation of a boundary. So many people have boundaries around social media usage or, say, their boss emailing them out of hours. They feel violated when their boss or colleague is constantly trying to reach them for not urgent reasons, you know, say on weekends. They feel like that's a violation of their personal time and space. So a limit could be, you know what? Could you not do that? I know that's really, really hard, but smart teams are learning how to enforce limits and understand people's different work styles. Other people, you know, for me, a boundary is I hate being expected to show up at an office all day when I don't have to be there. So I actually don't mind if my boss emails me as long as I don't have to sit at a desk.
Right.
So my limit would be, you know what? Let me work from home on Fridays. I promise I'll be contactable. Everyone's are different, but I think the key, and I have great exercises in the book, is to tune in to your boundaries at work and know when they're being crossed. A lot of introverts have boundaries of space. Too much hugging, too much hovering, too much open plan office. Oh my gosh, how do I set the limits that are going to actually help me get through the workday and do my best work?
It's a great book. It's a great concept. Hiding in the Bathroom, an Introvert's Roadmap to Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home. My guest and author, Maura Ahrens-Mealy. Maura, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Steve.
If you want to hear this interview again and you want to get these and many more informative interviews straight to your inbox, subscribe to our weekly update at stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, I know the stock market is soaring. I guess you can say that. What about new home sales? Are they going up too?
Oh, absolutely. The sales of, you know, the new U.S. homes have jumped last month, actually to the highest level since October 2007. A lot of it has to do, Steve, if you think about it, you know, we went through Irma, we went through Harvey. So a lot of these numbers, you know, because there's a lack of, well, there's a lack of inventory all across the country, but in these hard hit areas, a lot of people may be replacing homes or going to new construction.
Oh, yeah.
So I think the leap is kind of skewed a little bit to a higher level than it probably should be. But absolutely, irregardless of that, new home sales are rising.
Well, you know, that's good news for the economy. You know, the stock market is rising. I follow the stock market as a money manager day in and day out. And there's really good reasons for a rise in the stock market, in my opinion, because basically the economy is growing beautifully. We have low inflation, low interest rates, lots of what they say called Goldilocks. It's the Goldilocks scenario, not too hot, not too cold. But I think home sales are kind of getting the same. What about existing home sales? Are they showing any kind of pickup as well?
You know, the problem with the existing home sales is just there's no inventory.
Still,
I mean, it's down. It keeps dropping. Hello, sellers, if you're out there, put your home on the market, price it right, and it'll sell.
And then move out of the area or something.
And then just move out of the area and then go find a new development someplace where it's affordable. And actually, new construction firms are having problems finding people to work.
Oh.
That's part of the reason why we don't have as many new construction sites, is because it's hard for them to find workers.
Wow.
Which is kind of crazy, isn't it?
Well, you know, in a cycle when there's a lot of building, then workers become more scarce because they're all working. And then prices generally rise. They have to pay people more in order to get them to work, and prices start to rise. I mean, I don't really know what's going on in that industry, but if you're telling me that it's hard to find workers, it's probably one of the reasons that most of them are already working.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you sent me an article about one of the longer-term trends that we're seeing that's really going to have an effect on real estate in the future, and that is the long-term decline of childbirth rates. And how are they saying that's going to affect real estate?
Yeah, you know, you don't think about it, but, you know, a lot of these McMansions were built in the 80s, 90s. You have these, you know, extremely large homes. But, you know, when you go to sell those homes, you have to have somebody moving into those homes. And the trend is smaller homes because we're having smaller size families. There's also a trend where people are wanting to move more towards the downtown areas, city areas, where you find the McMansions, what have you, further out.
Yeah.
So that it is having an impact. You know, and people are basically delaying getting married and having fewer children. And long term, that's going to have an effect. It's not like it's a big effect going on right now.
Yeah.
If you have a McMansion, don't worry about trying to sell it. But it is something to think about in the future. And something else they were saying, according to the National Association of Builders, that home buyers tend to seek out properties that offer 800 square feet per person in their household.
That's an interesting statistic. I never saw that before.
No, neither had I.
Yeah. So if there's three people, we're talking about 2,400 square feet is kind of the average.
Right.
That people are looking for. So I don't know. What does that mean to you?
You know, it just makes me think that down the road, it's going to be harder to sell a lot of these very large homes that were out in the suburbs. You know, five, six, there's some houses that are seven bedrooms.
Yeah.
And there's three people living in the house.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. So there's a lot of boomers out there that have purchased these big suburban homes. And you're saying not right now, there isn't an issue. But as time goes on, there may be more of an issue to sell these bigger McMansions because people, as you say, are moving into smaller homes and they're moving closer to the cities or at least more urban type environments.
Right.
That's an interesting demographic change, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it's just something to be aware of and, okay. You know, keep in the back of your mind.
All right, I want to switch gears here because this is very important. You know, we work with a lot of clients that, you know, have assets and one of their primary assets is their home. And there's a very good question in your real estate survival guide this week. It asks, is it wise to add a child's name to older adults' deeds?
You know, it's interesting. It's a great question because my initial reaction says, yeah, that's a great idea. But when you really think about it and look into this, no, it's not necessarily a good idea. And to answer this question properly, everyone's situation is unique and different. You have to consult a tax attorney and your financial advisor.
Absolutely.
But to answer the question in general, you got to think about when you add an adult child to the deed, you're also giving them permission to say no to selling your house. So if you may be in a situation you want to sell the house, but the adult child refuses to. So that's going to, you know, prevent a problem for you.
The question is, do you really want to ask your child's permission to sell your house?
Right.
And you'll need to, yeah. So.
Right. And there's something else that I never really realized, that you're also subjecting the child, it now becomes part of their asset.
Yeah.
So if that child is getting sued or going through a divorce or filing bankruptcy, his or her creditors may attempt to collect against that asset. Mm-hmm. That may not be necessarily a good situation. And then there's maybe tax consequences as a result of this. You know, property that is transferred by inheritance is given very, you know, preferable tax treatment. At death, the IRS allows a stepped up basis on your investments once they've transferred into the hands of their heirs.
Yeah. So in other words, let me just say that very quickly. If you bought a house for $100,000 and it's worth $500,000 and you pass away, your heirs inherited at the stepped up basis of $500,000. If you've got someone else's name on the deed, then you know what? You may lose that step up in basis. And then when the house is sold, have to pay a lot of taxes.
Right.
Terry, we are out of time. I'm so sorry, but we got to go. So once
Ciao.
Again, my guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Coldwell Banker and can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
SteVePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Nelson DeMille is the New York Times best-selling author of 20 novels, six of which were number one New York Times bestsellers. His novel, The General's Daughter, was made into a major motion picture starring John Travolta and Madeline Stowe, and two others have been made into TV series starring Don Johnson and Aidan Quinn. Nelson DeMille is a combat-decorated U.S. Army veteran. He lives in Long Island with his family. Nelson DeMille, it's really an honor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, before we get started, I just want to tell you a quick story about my own personal introduction to your books. My daughter is currently 28. She's healthy and everything is wonderful. But back a while ago when she was 5 years old, she contracted a disease and she spent about 2 years in the hospital, in and out of different hospitals and the like. And I remember asking a friend, hey, I need a book. It was early on in her treatment. Can he recommend something? And he gave me your book. And I want to publicly thank you for helping me through those challenging times. I've read them all.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we can all get lost in books. That's the magic of books.
It sure is. Hey, I want to talk about your latest book, The Cuban Affair. But before we do, I want to talk about the publishing industry and the business side of being an author. Your very first book was The Sniper. In 1974, that was your first published book. Did you start out writing as a sideline, or was it a serious effort right off the bat?
Well, that's a good question. It was kind of a sideline. Those early books, and we like to forget about them, were all kind of paperback originals, and I think they sold for like $1.25 in those days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did not quit the day job. I was not making any money with these.
Yeah.
But in 1978... I got a break. I was introduced to a man named Bernie Geis, who had published Jacqueline Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls. And he had published some early William Peter Blatty books before The Exorcist. And he was kind of a mentor to young authors, and I was young then.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me a fantastic advance of maybe $30,000, which was a lot of money in 1970s. And he had an idea for a book called By the Rivers of Babylon, and that was my first hardcover.
Yeah.
And that was a Book of the Month Club main selection, a Reader's Digest book, and sold in foreign translation rights. So I went from relative poverty to relative comfort.
Yeah, I want to find out about that. How did you meet Bernie Geis? How did you come together?
Yeah, that's a good question, because, you know, I say to writers, aspiring writers, if you want to write, think about moving to New York. We know that you can do this from Dubuque, and we know that you can do it from any place in the country or in the world. But only because I lived in New York did I know people in the business. I didn't know many, but one leads to another to another. And I say I was doing this part-time, and somebody just introduced me to Bernie. And this is the cocktail party thing, and going to author events. You know, if you're a painter in the 1920s, you're going to live in Paris.
Paris.
And I always say to people, if you really want to be a writer, you're serious about novels, you need to live in New York because that's where you're going to find people who can help you. Now, a lot of this business is personal. It's a small business, not as big as people think it is. Publishing is kind of collegial.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the last businesses, I think, where it's not cutthroat. And people are looking to help. And, you know, a fortuitous break. But it would have happened anyway, one way or the other, because I was in that world as a paperback writer.
So getting in the world is incredibly important. Now, what did he do? Did he ask to see your work, or did he just talk to you about, I mean, how did he know that you had any talent?
Well, that was it. I had done these paperback originals, and Somebody I know gave them to him, and he read them, and said, this man's got talent.
Yeah.
And he's wasting his time on paperback originals, and we're going to make him a star.
Yeah, so it changed your life. 1978, By the Rivers of Babylon, was your first major novel, as you said. And how did your life change?
Well, my life changed by $400,000, actually.
Okay, that's one way. Yeah.
After taxes, which were very high in those days,
and
my agent, I didn't have an agent at that point, you know, but I was still very comfortable. It changed my life. The most important thing is that it allowed me the freedom to quit the day job and to concentrate on writing. I had to do that. That's why Bernie offered the advance. It was sort of, you know, patron of the arts, and I was able to live on money while I wrote the book.
Did it change the way you wrote? I mean, you wrote these other six novels. These paperback novels, then you had this hit, and did something crystallize in your mind, oh, this is a formula that I need to continue, or was there any change there?
Well, you know, in the business, they talk about the second book syndrome, which is your first book, and this really was my first book in terms of hardcover and, you know, mass distribution. You get self-conscious a little bit, and you say, oh my God, you know, they paid me a fortune for this one. What do I do for my second act? And the second book syndrome is not a good thing. It's usually the writer becomes self-conscious. The writing starts to get stilted. And he's trying to be too literary. I just kind of took a deep breath and came up with an idea. The name of the book was Cathedral. It was about the Irish Republican Army taking over St. Patrick's Cathedral and kidnapping the cardinal on St. Patrick's Day during the parade, which is this huge event in New York City.
Yeah.
It was a great idea, and I'd approached it as though I was writing, you know, my first novel. Best way to avoid the second novel syndrome is make believe each one is your first, I guess.
Well, I learned a lot about the inside of a church by reading that book.
Right.
All of the, you know, the different sections of the church, the apse and all of that. I didn't know any of that stuff. So I do remember that now that you mentioned that. So you wrote your second book, and did you have a main character at that point? Because I know that you've used four or more main characters during your career. I have questions about, you know, what makes you change a character and the like, but when did you first start to develop your first major character?
Well, you know, all my original books, and you're familiar with them, they're all standalones. I never meant to create a character, a continuing series. I read the series, you know, other authors, and they're good, but this wasn't me. I wanted to do something different every time. But back in the, I guess it was early 90s, I wrote a book called Plum Island with a character named John Corey. Thank you. And that was a huge bestseller.
Yeah.
And this John Corey character is a very politically incorrect, crazy NYPD detective. And it was meant to be a standalone, and you read it, and you see that as a standalone. But the reader reaction was so incredible. Plus, it was like 16 weeks on a bestseller list. And my agent and my publisher urged me to do a second book, which was not really a sequel per se, but a book that's going to continue this character. So there are now seven John Corey books. That's my main guy who pays the rent for me. But for this one, I didn't really want to continue with John Corey. I also switched publishers after 35 years.
Yeah.
Publisher wanted something new, which I thought was very brave of them because, you know, when they signed me on, I thought they were signing me on for John Corey, but actually they were signing me on for Nelson DeMille. So they said, forget John Corey, and quite frankly, some of your continuing characters in your other series are getting a little on in years and kind of ready for Social Security. Let's create a 35-year-old. I don't even know a 35-year-old, but I figured, okay, I can do this, you know? So that's why I created this guy, Mac McCormick, for The Cuban Affair, my new book.
Yeah. I want to talk about The Cuban Affair, but I still have some more questions about the business end of things. By the way, I'm talking with Nelson DeMille. Nelson is a New York Times bestselling author of 20 novels, six New York Times bestsellers. Of those novels were bestsellers, major motion pictures, TV series have been made out. He's a real legend. And you've been writing for 43 years now. At what point did you get an agent? And a lot of people say, you know, I need an agent in order to succeed. Which comes first, do you think?
Well, you do need an agent. There's no doubt about it. Or if you don't have an agent, you have to have a good lawyer who understands. And there are literary lawyers out there. And you need to prove yourself. You know, when I started, it was an easier business. A lot of writers started with paperback originals. All writers now want to go right to hardcover. And publishers kind of okay with this. But I entered this business in the 70s when writing paperback originals was okay, an okay thing to do. You honed your craft.
Yeah.
And it was the paperback originals that came to the attention of an agent who in turn took me to Bernie Geis, who became my mentor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to get something published with your name on it. And no matter how you do that, there's a lot of ways to go about it. Once you published, it's sort of like you've been knighted. Somebody has approved. A publisher has actually put time and effort and wasted a lot of trees and paper to get you between covers.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've done that once, then you at least have the doors open to you. And you know, if you have an agent, you're certainly golden because the publishers and the editors want to talk to agents and they want to talk to authors.
Yeah.
And I don't blame them.
Yeah. So when you finally get published, you exist.
Exactly. You're
no longer invisible.
A real person, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so the publishing world has changed dramatically in these last four decades that you've been writing. You mentioned what it was like in the early years. Let's just come right to the present time. We've got ebooks. We've got self-publishing as a major category. If you were out there today with your first books, tell me what you think it would be like and what you might do with all your current experience in order to succeed.
That's something I think about myself, and I've kind of evolved with the business. I am, more than most authors I know, business savvy, and maybe because I, for a while, was a business major in college before I switched to liberal arts, but I kind of understand how the business works now, and now when you write, and no matter how big an author you are, my new publisher, for instance, Lemon Schuster, asked me before we signed on, how is my social media? They want you to bring something to the table.
Yeah.
And what you got to bring to the table is not only a fan base, but a loyal fan base that follows you on Twitter or Facebook, Instagram, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that kind of in place when I went to the new publisher, and that was sweeten the deal.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to self-promote. In the old days, you just turn yourself over to the publisher, they send you out on book tour, and everything was in their hands. And now they're thrilled if you have your own publicist. And I sometimes hire a publicist for myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's changed. There's a lot of competition out there for readers' time. There's TV, there's everything, there's internet. So the market has become more and more fragmented. In the old days, back in the 70s, when a book like The Godfather, I always use these three examples, The Godfather, The Exorcist, and Jaws. These books sold like 12, 14, 15 million paperbacks, when paperbacks were big in those days. It was a common cultural experience for the country. Everybody read it. People will read the same book, you know, two or three times. But, I mean, the book's got a pass-on factor. So if you say you sold 15 million, maybe 30 million Americans read it. The market is much more fragmented now, and you're trying to grab a piece of that market, and you want your fan base to be loyal. And so you know that you're in competition, and you've got to follow your fan base, but at the same time, don't try to chase your fans. They're going to have to chase you.
Yeah.
It's a much more complex arrangement than it had been in the 60s and 70s. And then, you know, with the rise of the big box bookstores, that helped everyone, but now you have Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy books online, and you can buy ebooks. So the thing has changed. We used to depend on walk-in traffic for the holiday season to sell books. Now with, you know, Amazon ebooks and also Amazon buying them online, physical books online, there are no real seasons anymore. That's changed a little bit too.
I wonder if you can have a situation where 15 million books are sold. You can have a tremendously successful book, but the industry is so fragmented that I wonder if you could even reach anywhere near that number.
Yeah, very few people do. I mean, Dan Brown did with the Da Vinci Code,
true.
And there have been a few others. And then, of course, you have J.K. Rowling's books, you know, the Harry Potter books.
Of course.
But they're exceptions now. And a lot of the books that are really huge bestsellers are children's books. That may be a common cultural experience for kids, but adults, no, not so much anymore.
Interesting. You know, you still write your books in longhand, right, on legal pads.
What's
up with that?
I can't type. I learned how to write with a pencil when I was in the second grade, and it worked.
I don't know. How much erasing do you do?
No erasing. Always just cross outs.
Cross out, yeah. Are you drawing arrows and things like that?
Yes, exactly. I draw arrows and I do cross outs. I make marginal notes. All the things I can't do on a computer. And I give it to my poor, long-suffering assistant, and she puts it into the computer.
Yeah.
And then I can play with it on a computer, but I refuse to type a manuscript from beginning to end.
Let's talk about the Cuban affair. So it obviously takes place in Cuba. You described the main character for a moment there, but you went over to Cuba to research this book and develop it. What did you find there that you didn't expect to find? And I know I read something where you said you didn't realize the sense of the place until you actually got back to the States and started writing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I had that kind of same experience in one of my earlier books that you may have read, The Charm School, which is set in the Soviet Union. I went to the Soviet Union in 87 at the time of Chernobyl, at the time of, high tension between the two countries. You know, I grew up in the Cold War era. I read every Cold War book probably known to man for fun, not for research. Mm-hmm. So I thought I understood the Soviet Union and all. And when I got to Moscow, it just was totally different. And I had the same experience when I went to Havana. I mean, we all think we know Cuba. It's been in the news and so close to us physically that, you know, I know a lot of Cuban Americans here in New York, and I also know some in Miami. So you think, well, I know this place. But once you step into the country, the whole thing changes. And I'd written about a third of the book before I went. I had to go back. I had the same experience with the Charm School in the Soviet Union. I had to go back and really put the stuff in there that you can only get with boots on the ground. All the armchair research and the internet research and even interviewing Cuban Americans didn't give me that kind of sense of place that I found when I stepped into Havana. I stepped off the plane to 90-degree heat in October, and I looked around me and I said, I don't know this place at all. And I think anybody who does that kind of field research will probably say the same thing.
Well, Nelson, we are unfortunately out of time. For my listeners, if you want to hear this interview again, and you want to get these and many more informative interviews straight to your inbox, don't forget to subscribe to our weekly update at stevepomeranz.com. We are, of course, as Nelson is on Twitter and all of the social media, come to stevepomeranz.com to hear this interview again. And actually, we have transcriptions of it and summaries as well. Nelson, I wish we had another 30 minutes, but I do appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your life. Thank you so much. Good luck with the book.
Thanks, Steve.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomeranz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomeranz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomeranz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.